Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today marks the first summit of the Quad, the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue. Relatively new organizations, as the prime ministers of India, Japan, and Australia meet at the White House today with the president to discuss ways to counteract China's growing strength and influence in tech, the regional economy, security, and more. This is just one of the ways the United States is, quote, competing, unquote, to use the words of the Biden administration, with China. The recent announcement that the U.S. will share key submarine technology with Australia is another area that points to the strategic nature of Southeast Asia. My guest today has written about the U.S.-China competition in that region of the world, one of two books he's written this year. Dr. David Shambaugh was a guest at the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night and is an internationally recognized specialist on China. He's a professor of Asian Studies, Political Science, and International Affairs at George Washington University. And for 20 years, he was a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and has been a Wilson Fellow and a senior Fulbright Scholar, among numerous honors. His 30 books include two published this year, Where Great Powers Meet, America and China in Southeast Asia, and China's Leaders from Mao to Now. He's a frequent guest with the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations and a frequent guest here on Studio Tulsa as well. David Shambaugh, welcome back to Studio Tulsa, and welcome back to Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, great to see you, and great to be back at Tulsa and the university.
Your book, Where Great Powers Meet, has examined the rivalry and influence-building campaigns both China and the United States have been working on with the nations of Southeast Asia. The world kind of focused on this last week when the Australian submarine agreement with the U.S. and the U.K. was announced. What is the impact of this agreement?
I think it's a largely, I was going to say, symbolic agreement, but obviously there's real substance to it. It'll give the Australian Navy really long-range submarine projection, power projection, up into the South China Sea and the waters of East Asia, because nuclear submarines can go further and then go more quietly than diesel-electric submarines. So there is certainly, there will be impact. Mind you, it's going to take several years to build these. And Australia is the first country other than the United Kingdom with whom the United States has shared nuclear submarine technology. So I think it'll probably be 5 years or six even before these go to sea. And that will alter to some extent the naval balance in the South China Sea. But it's a symbolic step too, to try, for the Australians in particular. They've really become increasingly concerned with China's growing military modernization and its militarization of the South China Sea, and even their, you know, threats to the South Pacific islands that are right next door to both Australia and New Zealand. The Chinese have established a pretty increasing footprint in Fiji, Tuvalu, these smaller states, but geostrategically, this is very important. And there's some reports, in fact, the Chinese are going to establish a submarine base of their own down there in the South Pacific, which is, amongst other things, very close to Guam, which is the major American base in that part of the world. So there's a kind of contest for, you know, positioning, geostrategic positioning in the South Pacific and South China Sea. So the Australian submarine deal has to first be viewed through that lens. And secondly, of course, the French are extremely upset, put it mildly, about the cancellation of the $66 billion contract that they had previously had with the Australians to build diesel electric submarines. So that's not 66 million, that's 66 with a B, billion. So I can understand, well, first of all, why the French are upset, but they're really upset by not just the cancellation of the contract, but the lack of consultation amongst the United States, Australia, and the UK with them ahead of time. So they've got a point, put it mildly. They've got a real case. And it's a real embarrassment to the Biden administration, frankly, and how they handled this. It's surprising to me.
Yes, I mean, he was the foreign policy professional, and this seems like a 101 is that you tell your allies that you're going to do something they're not going to like before it's announced to the public.
Yeah, and he has put, and his administration has put, transatlantic relations at the forefront of the Biden foreign policy, right? Rebuild transatlantic trust. And Secretary of State Blinken is a fluent French speaker, amongst other things, and he's a Europhile. Philip Gordon, who's the National Security Advisor to Vice President Harris, similarly. So there's, you know, they put Europe at the top of their priority list, and here they go and flub this one completely with the French. So that's not exactly how you rebuild trust across the Atlantic after the Trump period.
And I guess, you know, as a lot of the observers really have focused on this French reaction, and a lot of European observers have said, yep, this is a sign that the United States doesn't really care about Europe anymore. They care about the Pacific.
And this is coming on the back end of the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the lack of consultation with European allies about that. So the Europeans, they don't think this is exactly Trump 2.0, but they don't see the kind of consistency with the language and the rhetoric coming out of Washington about transatlanticism that they had heard. Now, back in June, they had the G7 meeting, the US-EU meeting, and the US-NATO meetings, all of which went extremely well, all of which put China and the Asia-Pacific, Indo-Pacific, I should say, at the center of their agendas. So things were fine going into the summer, but in the last 4 weeks, there's been a significant denting of the U.S. image in Europe. So it's going to take some work to repair and rebuild. Mind you, this comes after 4 years of Trump. You know, so the Europeans are skeptical, to put it mildly, of U.S. assurances.
Well, it seems like there's a big back and forth between U.S. operating unilaterally and multilaterally. And, I mean, these two events would suggest to Europeans that it's more of the same unilateralism, not multilateralism.
And the Biden administration has got to correct that, you know, and that was what they have said when they came into office. We're going to re-embrace multilateralism, rejoin all these international organizations that Trump withdrew from. Biden himself gave a very multilateralist speech at the UN just a couple of days ago. So that is still their rhetoric, and I think it's not disingenuous, but the actions that we've seen with Afghanistan and the submarine deal are not consistent with that broader perspective.
Well, let's go back to the submarine deal, and how is China likely to react?
They don't like it. tough, you know. So the Chinese are, there are a lot of problems in U.S.-China relations, and we can go into that, Rich, I'm sure. I think you want to. But they are increasingly critical of what they call small groupings that the United States is organizing. The U.S. calls these mini-laterals as opposed to multilaterals. Multilateral are real institutions. And then the U.S. goes into these mini-laterals with groups of three or four countries, depending on the issue. In this case, it's three countries, Australia, U.K., U.S. Friday, if I'm not mistaken, this week, they're having the Quad meeting in Washington of India, Australia, Japan, and the United States. All four leaders will meet together physically for the first time. So that's another kind of mini lateral. So the Chinese are, you know, being surrounded, you might say, by these new mini laterals, and they're very critical of them. They don't like them at all. And they feel that they are the target of these. And to a large extent, they are.
Yeah, they are. You know, there are groupings of countries that are looking at things like hacking and cyber issues. There's another one looking at trade issues. And each time, the United States has been sort of the instigator of trying to put forth a collective opinion countering some Chinese policy.
Yes, but I think for our listeners and Americans in general and others in other countries, we have to understand that these groups are not just about China. Take the Quad. You know, it's a proactive, positive organization on a number of fronts, on trade fronts, on vaccines. Their first meeting was all about the distribution of vaccines and about COVID. Didn't have a word about China in it. So this is not containment 2.0, I guess is the point I'm trying to make. China is certainly an element of these groupings, but it's not the sole element.
Is it possible that China definitely views that as containment?
Oh, sure, but they view everything as containment, frankly. They think any American action, there's a black American hand behind anything that happens in their neighborhood. They think the U.S. is out to restrain them and hold them back and hold them down. And so they have a kind of default perception for a long time, I might say. This is not recent. I wrote my PhD dissertation four decades ago, and they had views about the American black hand then and consistently ever since. So that's just their kind of default view of the United States. So they see, you know, American maneuverings where they may not be, or they'll exaggerate American maneuverings, and they think they're the target of everything. So they're a little bit insecure, put it mildly.
No, I think the same could be true of segments of our public opinion as well, mm-hmm. because I think there's a body politic within the United States that would like to do exactly that.
You bet. And we've seen a radical shift in American thinking about China in the last 5, 6, 7 years, really. I date the sea change in American perspectives on China to the late Obama administration. It wasn't just Trump, but there was a growing disaffection with China and the U.S.-China relationship in the last 2 years of Obama. Then comes Trump. We have 4 years of outright hostility, really, and a lot of substantive actions that the Trump administration took vis-a-vis China that no previous administration had ever dared to go there. They had considered, but they hadn't done it. So that was 4 years of counteractions. I'm not going to call it containment because it wasn't containment. You know, those of us who are old enough, you and me, remember the Soviet Union and containment. You know, you have to line everybody else up to contain another party. And we can talk about this in the context of Southeast Asia, for example. But other Asian countries don't want to contain China. So it's a question of how to push back against Chinese assertiveness and aggression and drawing lines. The Chinese are getting very aggressive and assertive in a variety of ways, rhetorically and in practice. So, you know, the U.S. and other Asian countries and even European countries now have had a similar kind of sea change in their own mindset and thinking about China. They no longer look to China just as a partner to engage with. And so this has been a shift in world affairs that we're living through. It's ongoing. But, you know, it's not the Second Cold War because you can't contain China like you could the Soviet Union. And all other countries have an interest in China, big economic interests, cultural exchange interests. So the interdependencies between China and everybody else is qualitatively different than we saw in Cold War 1.0.
My guest today is David Shambaugh. He's a professor of Asian Studies, Political Science, and International Affairs at George Washington University. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. He's the author of two books this year, Where Great Powers Meet, America and China in Southeast Asia, and a relatively brand new book, China's Leaders from Mao to Now. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, a lot of people expected a reset of U.S.-Chinese relations with the Biden administration after the Trump administration. But I have to say, to a casual observer, that reset has been fairly muted. What has changed and what has not?
Well, Rich, to be honest, I think the only people that really expected or hoped for a reset were the Chinese. You know, if you've been following the American thinking about China, we were just discussing at the elite level in the foreign policy expert communities and at the public level, if you look at American public opinion polls about China, over the last several years, there's been real consensus about the dangers, threats, and problems and challenges that China presents to the United States. And you see this, as I said, in Asian countries to some extent, and you see it in European countries to a growing extent. So, long story short, I don't think really anybody expected a reversion, you know, to the glory days of engagement under Biden, that Trump was somehow an aberration and everything was going to go back to, you know, blissful harmony. The Chinese, there's some evidence the Chinese actually hoped for that, but it hasn't happened, as you say. And the Biden administration, you know, has continued Trump policies and they've put in place some new ones of their own. Mind you, we're only 8 months, 9 months into the administration. They're still undertaking an official review of China policy, which they haven't completed yet. They're about to release a new Indo-Pacific strategy report sometime very soon, could even come later this week with a meeting of the Quad in Washington. So that will be an outgrowth of these policy reviews they've been undergoing. But long story short, you're right. There's been nothing but continuity, really, between Trump and Biden. The rhetoric level has lowered from the Trump years, and the trade issue is not front and center as it was under Trump. For the Biden people, it's more geostrategic, really on a global basis. And Biden, last thing I'll say about this, he uses the word competition all the time. We are in a competition with China. And it's very interesting. Biden describes this competition in a variety of domestic areas, everything from infrastructure to education to technology to standards, tech standards. So a number of elements of Biden's domestic policies that are wrapped up in these two big omnibus bills that are sitting in the Congress is all about trying to make the United States competitive for the 21st century, is what he calls it. Well, he then frequently tells people this is about competing with China. So his idea of competing with China is not a kind of, you know, containment oriented. It's a very much getting us up to scratch in all these areas.
So you're saying like China has invested greatly in infrastructure and connections with its neighbors around it,
Belt and Road.
The Belt and Road. And this is the United States' response. We have to invest in our infrastructure the same way?
Yeah, he sees it that way. He sees this, and he speaks explicitly about it, as a kind of tipping point. The United States is going to lose the competition to be world leader in the 21st century to China, because China's been investing in these things, not just infrastructure, but engineering, graduates, you know, a lot of stuff. So all I'm trying to point out for listeners is that the thinking about China begins at home here in the United States for the Biden administration. It certainly has a big military and foreign policy component to it, really on a global basis. But it's a different definition of the China challenge than we saw from Trump, which is really all about trade deficits. It was really rather simplistic, frankly.
Yeah. A lot of it is focused on geopolitical activities and specifically in the South China Sea, which is where your book comes in. These other countries who are, you know, they don't want to be part of a great game, if you will, between China and the United States. How are they reacting to, you know, this flexing of muscle by both of these superpowers in this area?
Well, they're caught in the middle, literally, geographically and figuratively and substantively. There are 10, or actually 11 countries in Southeast Asia, 10 of which are members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And all these countries want to have the best relations with both the U.S. and China possible. You know, they're not going to change geography. China is the biggest power in the region to their north. The United States is obviously all the way across the Pacific, but the U.S. has had a very long-standing, two-century-long-standing position in Southeast Asia. And our American footprint is actually quite broad and quite deep. I go into some detail in this book you just mentioned about it. And this is one of the surprise findings, I might say, in researching this book. I spent 2 years out in Southeast Asia working on it and traveled to all the countries in the region. One of the things I learned was that the narrative about China overtaking the region is vastly overstated, and the narrative about America abandoning and not being, you know, present or influential in the region is vastly understated. U.S. footprint is broad and deep in many areas, and the Chinese is shallow, I would argue, and not very deep and not particularly broad. So it's kind of interesting. This is one of these research projects I got into. I wasn't quite sure what I was going to find and where I would wind up. But the book argues that both powers are present in the region. The region itself wants both powers present. They don't want to be forced to choose. And so this is a tricky balancing act for them. And either side, Beijing or Washington, if they were to ask the Southeast Asian countries to choose one over the other, that would be a big misstep and a miscalculation. So it's a very, diplomatically, this is a really difficult line to walk for both Beijing and Washington. So hopefully the U.S. can play its hand adroitly. And part of that is letting the Chinese overstep. Mind you, the Chinese are, I argue, I have a lot of evidence and arguments in the book. They're doing all kinds of stuff, including the Belt and Road program, where they're kind of tone deaf and blind to how they're being perceived in these countries. And they're pushing people around. They're acting, you know, almost like autistically, you might say. A great power autism, somebody once referred to it as. So, you know, they don't have much sense of themselves. The Chinese are on autopilot in many parts of the world. Southeast Asia, I argue, is the epicenter of U.S.-China global competition, right there in on their doorstep. But they're not, they don't listen, they don't see themselves the way others see them, and therefore they're overreaching, overstepping. And from the American perspective, that's fine. Just let them do it, because then the Southeast Asians will pull away from China and hopefully closer to the U.S.
That's also been a not infrequent
right.
observation of
about
U.S.
the United
policy.
States, exactly. And Americans were accused of great power autism as well.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you, you said something. You said, you know, I found when I researched this, I found that the U.S. footprint is wider and deeper than I thought. What was one of the surprising things that you found?
Well, commercially, for example, the United States, this is my favorite statistic, The foreign direct investment from the United States into Southeast Asia is not only greater than China, it's greater than China, South Korea, and Japan combined. Think about that. And the Japanese have huge investments in Southeast Asia. So do the South Koreans. So it's, I think, about $32 billion a year from the U.S., and the Chinese investment is about $18 billion a year in 2018 are the last figures that come to mind. So that's one element. American corporations, there are, oh gosh, I think there are 14,000 American companies headquartered in Singapore alone. Mind you, that's kind of a hub for the region. A lot of them headquarter there and then operate all across the region. But you go to many countries, not all, but the Philippines, Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand. GM, you know, has been building trucks and cars in Thailand for 3.5 decades. So there are countries where the U.S. does not have a commercial footprint. So that was a big surprise. I didn't appreciate that. I certainly expected to find, and I found, the American strategic military footprint far, far, far in a way greater than anybody else, including the Chinese, which is good. All the regional militaries look to the U.S., or most of them, Cambodia, Myanmar excepted, and Brunei. Brunei, former colony of the U.K., still looks to the U.K. for their assistance. But the U.S. security support, first rate. Where we fall apart, and it's a real failing, and we deserve not only criticism for it, but we really got to up our game, is in diplomacy and public diplomacy. We just don't show up, our senior leaders, and we need to do that. You know, we have parachute diplomacy. Our Secretary of State or Vice President will fly in, give a few reassuring speeches, as Kamala Harris did last month, fly out, and then not be seen for another 6 months. Well, that's not sufficient. And the public diplomacy is equally important, because there's this pervasive narrative, as I say, in the region, that China is the big, most important player on the block. And in fact, that's not the case. So America's got to do better about telling Southeast Asians what, in fact, the United States does do in the region, and calling China out for its own missteps.
My guest today, David Shambaugh, professor of Asian Studies, Political Science, and International Affairs at George Washington University. He's a guest of the Committee on Foreign Relations here in Tulsa, author of two new books, including Where Great Powers Meet, America and China in Southeast Asia. I do want to touch on one thing, and this is the strength of the Chinese economy. Markets have been roiling, at least in Asian markets, over a possible real estate bubble with Evergrande. There's also talk of the consumer spending on things like auto purchases, big, heavy, major purchases, is also falling in China. Mm-hmm. And there's big concern about a real estate bubble. What is your feeling about that? Is this a concern for China?
Well, I'm not an economist. I have to preface any views I have, which are more opinions than well-researched views. But, you know, there are some chickens that are coming home to roost, you might say, in the Chinese economy. The Evergrande case is emblematic of the very high debt loads that Chinese corporations have been carrying for a decade or so. In fact, Rich, I sat here in your studio in 2016, and we talked about my book then, China's Future. And in that book, I argued about the debt load being at 220% of GDP. Well, it's up around 320% of GDP today, depending on what estimate you read, 300, 320. That's just unsustainable. That's at a national level, most of which is corporate debt. So Evergrande is kind of the tip of the iceberg. There are dozens of Evergrandes in the queue behind them with huge debt that should default under normal circumstances. And we're going to wait and have to see if the Chinese government lets these companies, plural, go under. There's no indication so far that they're going to bail Evergrande out. So that's why global markets are really rattled, because that kind of the debt situation in China is, you know, is unsustainable. When you get, economists tell me, real economists, if you get above 200% or 180% of GDP, that's red light flashing territory. As I say, the Chinese have been above that for over a decade. And so that will just cascade across the world. So that's one big problem, the debt load. Then you have overbuilding of infrastructure, hard buildings, bridges, all kinds of heavy infrastructure, hard infrastructure, which has been kind of a gravy train situation. The Chinese just keep funding that, also with fiscal priming from the central government. So that's fueling local government debt, right? The local government has to keep employment levels up and they want to build their various bridges and cities, but they're building bridges to nowhere. In fact, ghost cities, quite literally. Mm-hmm. There are dozens of ghost cities in China, huge apartment blocks and cities with no human beings in them. So that's been a problem for a while. Then you've got the environmental issues. Then you have the demographics of China growing old before they grow rich. What was it, 43 years ago, they crossed the threshold where there are more people going into retirement that are entering the labor market every year. And that's only going to continue. So they've relaxed the birth control policies now, but that's not going to have much any near-term effect anyway. So they're facing declining birth, declining growth rates related to birth rates. And lastly, there are many more things you could go into in the Chinese economy, but they're in what economists call the middle income trap now. And that's a stage of development that all economies go through between developing and developed. They go into this middle income area, and most of them get trapped. The World Bank tells us that there have been 101 countries since 1960 that went into that stage, 89 of which are still there. They're stuck. Only 12 out of 101 have graduated, you might say, through and become fully developed economies. So, China's beginning to experience, this is on the negative side, mind you, there are positives to the Chinese economy too, particularly in the tech sector. But in the financial sector, the banks, employment issues, environmental issues, this country has a lot of problems, and so does the United States, of course, so does everybody. But what you're beginning to see, I think, in the Chinese economy has got a lot of people worried and very nervous now because it's not sequestered, right? It's just what goes wrong in China will rebound across the world tomorrow.
And the governance of China is sort of dependent on everything going smooth.
Well, now you've got a new dynamic. Xi Jinping has decided he wants to really remold the country in a more socialist direction. He's always been inclined that way, but he's taking some steps recently. And one of the steps he's taking is to crack down on big tech and these really very wealthy, successful companies, Alibaba, Tencent. Those are two that may be known to our listeners, but many others. So he's doing that. He's cracking down on the entertainment industry, private tutoring industry, ride-sharing industry. These are the most successful private companies in the Chinese economy. That's what's producing the 8% growth every year, not the state companies. But Mr. Xi comes from a different generation, and his idea of a successful economy is one run by the state. So he's doing all that stuff and cracking down on social areas, too. Kids can't play video games now, except on Sunday nights between 7 and 9. It's just all kinds of strange things going on in the last 6 weeks in China. And we China specialists are trying to connect the dots between these steps that Xi Jinping is taking. But, that's also causing concern in foreign markets. Yeah. There's a lot of volatility in China as of late.
Well, we leave it there. David Shambaugh, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Great to see you, Rich.
China expert David Shambaugh, professor of Asian Studies, Political Science, and International Affairs at the George Washington University. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. And he's the author of two new books released in 2021, Where Great Powers Meet, America and China in Southeast Asia, and his latest, China's Leaders from Mao to Now. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.